All right, welcome to another WaitingForNextYear.com podcast. Second time I'm being joined by Scott Rabb. Sorry, I do that every time. I get all
Everyone does, man.
I get nervous when I'm talking to you for some reason.
Yeah, but it's because I'm so important.
Well, I'm sure it'll only get easier as we continue to talk, but we're going to take on a really, really tough topic today. I'm glad you were able to join me to talk about this one because it has kind of so much gravity and it's so present right this second, and that's the Steubenville case. And before we got on the air, you were talking about something closer to your home in Glen Ridge, New Jersey, where an eerily similar case happened in the 80s and came to a head in the late 90s. So why don't you bring everybody up to speed as to what we were talking about?
Well, it took place, the rape itself took place in 1989, and in that case, and we had moved, we didn't move to the town, to Glen Ridge, New Jersey, until 93. But in that case, the victim has a very small school system, but very oriented toward athletics. And in this case, the victim was a developmentally disabled young woman whose IQ has been variously put forth as high 40s, mid 60s, but someone. Someone who clearly had no ability to consent, to know what she was consenting to. It was the basement rec room scenario. There were seven football players present, including mostly seniors, including brothers and you know, one quarterback, co-captain, and on and on and on. She was penetrated with a baseball bat and a broomstick. They were trying to come up with a second, you know, trying to get her back downstairs a second time so they could videotape. Of course, this was an era, 1989, where texts, you know, there was no such thing. Social media hadn't risen to the level that led, in the Steubenville case, really led to the successful prosecution. The incident wasn't even reported, didn't become known to school officials here in Glen Ridge until a couple of months, I think almost 3 months later. Unlike Steubenville, this is a small, pretty affluent suburb, and the families of the accused were able to lawyer up pretty good. So even though they were convicted as adults, they were sentenced as youth offenders, and in fact, none of them began to even serve sentences until 8-9 years after the incident, until the late 90s, and then they were sent to. Three of them were sent to youth correctional facilities. They were all out of those facilities by the early 2000s. So.
Well, and the one place where it seems like the Glen Ridge case is a massive departure is that, you know, her IQ and ability to consent seems less relevant in something. Who in their right mind would ever consent to something like that? I mean,
I think the "in the right mind" phrase. But you know, yeah. It may have all kinds of legal definitions. In the Steubenville case, we're talking about someone who was blind drunk, who was unconscious. I think one of the fascinating things in both trials, the victim's behavior was part of the defense lawyer's efforts to exonerate their clients. That in the Glen Ridge case, we're dealing with fairly severe developmental disability, questions of her so-called alleged promiscuity arose.
Right.
And you know, I guess what I'm suggesting is two completely different towns, two very similar incidents. The differences, I think, mean very little compared to the similarities. So the Steubenville case, despite the way it was covered, it's the downscale, hard scrabble town that's fallen on hard times, and the football team is all they have. And the Glen Ridge case, which is an extremely affluent community, where the football team culturally is every bit as important, even though by comparison it sucks.
Right.
You know, and this town in no real way is hard scrabble, hurt by the recession. All that we have is the football. But the culture of sports to this day rules, it isn't just Steubenville, and it isn't just Glen Ridge. And one of the things that no longer shocks me at my age is how shocked everyone pretends to be or truly is
right.
by this stuff. This stuff is as common as a stone. You know, same thing with the Sandusky trial, by the way. I'm not trying to, you know, get all over the map, but again, we have the level of outrage and shock that it says so much about people's ignorance of the reality, and not just of sexual predation, but of things like incest. You know, people like to pretend, and the news certainly encourages it, like all these things are outliers, and the people who perpetrate them are monsters. And that of course, you know, is a very, very convenient and easy way to avoid actually thinking about things like high school culture and sports.
Well, and that hits on a part of the reaction to the sentencing that really bothered me. The sentencing seemed to be greeted in the news and in public online and wherever it was commented on with some kind of a celebration. And I do my best not to get political on these things because we're not a political, it's not really my thing, but it the sentencing of these two kids felt kind of like, you know, George Bush standing in front of the banner on the warship saying mission accomplished.
Yep.
This is the tip of the iceberg. And even if you're a Republican, you have a tough time looking at that piece of history without cringing. And so these two kids, they get sentenced. They deserve to be sentenced. They had to be sentenced. But you can't stop there. You absolutely cannot stop there. And I think any kind of satisfaction, any sense of satisfaction over the sentencing would be to try and pin this on a couple of people and not get at the real problem.
Well, there are so many real problems involved and so much difficulty in people comprehending, you know, the fact that it, in the range of human behaviors, as horrific as this is, and to be able to discuss it in some kind of perspective and context is not to excuse the crime. It is not to minimize the damage done to the victim. You have to be able to say that there is more to it than simply putting, you know, two horrible, you know, subhuman beings away. I don't, first of all, don't believe in that characterization despite the acts they were convicted for. Secondly, and on a broader level, it's just a convenient way not to question the town's culture, the coach's behavior, and I know that you know, Mike DeWine is going to be, there's certainly going to be other people brought to trial as a result of how the incident was handled. But, you know, the culture that we live in right now, which just seeks to, you know, closure, and everything is I think, you know, this, the media, and I'm, God knows I'm part of it, you know, is parasitical in the worst way and two-dimensional in the worst way and plays into people's need not to think very hard about the culture, not the broad and abstract, we got to put God back in the schools, the way we raise kids, the way we reinforce certain behaviors, the way alcohol, which is a legally sanctioned drug, it's not blaming alcohol. It is taking, being able to take a look at these things and the examples that we set. I mean, the fact that if you got a kid, I have a 13-year-old, you're not going to be able to sit through any sporting event watching together without seeing a dozen or more commercials that portray beer as the most desirable substance ever manufactured. I'm not saying that excuses rape or explains it. I'm simply saying you can't deny alcohol as a part of these scenarios. There is a lot of stuff here. Go ahead. I could just, you know, obviously ramble on for hours.
Well, no, I think a parallel needs to be drawn between this, and I think a lot of this, people are kind of going to the memory banks and using the same reactions they have over school shootings. Like, hey, a kid walks into Chardon High School and shoots the place up, that it's very convenient to just grab the psycho and put him behind bars, and they kind of want to do the same thing with these two kids down in Steubenville, I think. Like, you know, we've cut around and we've removed the tumor, problem solved. And meanwhile, I think the appendage might need to be removed completely and totally. Yes, these guys were a tumor on the arm, But it's the alcohol. It's the culture of partying. I mean, I finally came to a conclusion with the victim, because so many people are like, well, you can't blame the victim. And I agree, you can't blame the victim. Can I blame her parents?
I don't know any more that it's safe to even have the discussion. Can you blame her parents? Of course. You can apportion things based on listening knowledge, really, of people involved. There's no one in the media, no one writing about this, no one parsing it, including you and me, who knows the people involved. But I think at some point you have to be able to talk about not just the victim's, I don't know, personal, whatever sense of personal responsibility, you know, might be involved. You have to be able to raise that issue, at least be able to talk about that. And you know, talk about the awareness or lack thereof. We don't know if she was drugged. In addition to the drinking, there was at least, you know, some report that she couldn't really explain her blackout or her lapse into unconsciousness simply based on the amount of alcohol she consumed. We don't know that. We don't know in a case like Mike Tyson's, where again the defense argued, well, she knew whose hotel room. Our client is an animal, Your Honor. Clearly, Ms. Washington is responsible. I don't think I'd want to go there, but you have to be able to talk about that, or you have to be able to. I mean, God forbid, poor Candy Crowley on CNN. And I'm not justifying any of the reporting that I've seen, but to even raise the idea that there is a certain degree of sadness involved, because these are two guys who committed a crime, who will, you know, do time for that crime. To say that that's also a sad thing is not some awful offense. I mean, we are.
I'm really glad you brought that up, because I was just, I've been doing my best to stay off social media with this, because I knew I wanted to discuss it in a longer form. But I'm seeing this link posted everywhere today from Gawker, and everybody's picking it up, saying that CNN was hand-wringing and worrying about the fates of these two guys. Meanwhile, their entire coverage has been all. I mean, they've covered every angle of it. So on the day of sentencing, they come back and they show the actual sentencing and how devastating a moment that is for those two people. And that's the essence of punishment. Nothing respects a victim more than the punishment and the fact that it's devastating to the perpetrators of the crime, right?
Who were clearly not play acting when they were weeping and apologizing. Because again, this is really the problem. It's political correctness is certainly part of it, but overall, we're in a zero-sum culture, meaning there can only be right and wrong. There's no nuance. Any area of gray means that you have betrayed certain principles. Everyone can hide behind identity politics, you know, whether we're talking about race, whether we're talking about gender. You and I and a lot of other people aren't free to say things without being, you know, personally attacked for not being women in this case, or for not being African-American, or for not being this, or for not being that. And that's the culture we live in. There is no, you know, I mean, not to even drag the sequester into it or abortion rights into it. There is no middle ground in the culture on almost any issue. I'm right, you're wrong, you're a godless idiot, you know, I'm a righteous, whatever. And it's just, you know, where do you ever come to any degree of understanding, compromise, overall sense of community? And that's why we have a justice system, by the way, because if it weren't innocent until proven guilty in theory, there would be far more lynchings and other examples of mob justice based purely on emotion. That's pretty much what we're reduced to in a case like this.
Yeah. So you also mentioned something about the sentencing and adults versus being sentenced as underage in the Glen Ridge case. Did you think these two should have been sentenced as adults?
No, honestly, I don't. I mean, part of, you know, this is again one of the zero sum aspects of it. If people are making an argument that these men, their age, are beyond redemption, and that the sole goal of the justice system should be to mete out justice as harshly as possible in proportion to the fiercest, angriest emotion raised by what we know about the case. If that's the point, then sure, not just try them as adults. Put them away forever, because clearly that system is strictly designed to punish. It is not designed to offer any hope of rehabilitation or redemption. I'd like to think, you know, not that I think I've done anything, certainly as felonious, as horrible, as outrageous as this, but I'd like to think that I've been capable, as someone, you know, who committed his share of felonies over the years in other areas of human endeavor, that I've managed to you know, through the grace of God or whatever, have managed to grow as a human being. That's not unique to me. It's not up to me to judge whether someone else, in this case, 17 and 16-year-old kids, you know, should enter the justice system, to go to a state penitentiary as adults at this point in their lives. I don't know. It doesn't seem like that's proportionate, not to the crime itself, but just to the overall situation, given their age and, you know, these are not hardened criminals.
So I'll reveal something to you. I cram for tests. I'm serial about it. The first time I had you on, the couple of days before, I was rereading parts of your book and checking out all the things that you'd written in the last few days. And I did it again today. And I saw your interview with Mark Burnett, and I've written over 1,000 words on the Steubenville thing already, just because that's how I kind of get my thoughts out. And he brought up Lord of the Flies.
Yes.
And that's something that I came to as well, you know, where instead of Piggy being murdered, you know, this was a weird modern suburban Lord of the Flies situation where you still have to blame the criminals, but
sure,
the culture itself, I mean, how broken do you think this culture was? It was a youthful culture out of control. This wasn't an adult culture out of control. Could you imagine the same case happening to a bunch of 30 somethings?
Well, not in the same way, but you know, over the years, you know, these things have happened in the context of, you know, tail hook. You know what I mean? Military celebration. I mean, we don't have to Google this while we're talking, but I'm saying this is not as aberrant as it seems, as outrageous as it seems. You know, there are things like this that go on, especially among, you know, males in a tribal. We're talking about a certain kind of tribal culture in Steubenville and Glenridge. It was a football-driven culture. Such things go on in military cultures. Such things go on in fraternity, you know, the Greek system cultures. We see amazing trials, you know, based on fatalities, murders. It's an outlier. Of course it is. But every time it happens, again, we pretend as if, oh, my God, this is so outside the norm of human behavior. I'm simply saying it's not that far outside. You know, and until we realize it and are able to approach it as something other than, you know, monsters doing monstrous things, lock them away and be done with it, how are we ever going to even begin to have a fruitful dialogue about what's going on here?
So I was also discussing this with my wife, you know, because I obviously, in my own personal political correctness, you know, I do want a woman's perspective on it. And one of the big takeaways from my conversations with her was that the additional added on degradation of having this turn into a cruel private internet meme,
yep,
where
yep,
they're
yep,
taking pictures and movies and passing it around and making this girl just the butt of all these, like, really, really perverse jokes. How much of that do you think plays into the reaction and how big of a story this became?
I think it outrages, you know, people in kind of in proportion to their distance, whether it's in age or experience or both, from how universal and distancing this has become. Meaning, meaning that, that so much of the communication in this age group is via Facebook, YouTube, and texting. And I think in many ways, of course, that's a great thing. You know, it's convenient, it's instant, it's you know, cost-free in certain ways. Literally, I'm talking about it. But at the same time, it does the same thing that any comments section does. It allows people to feel absolutely boundaryless in terms of moral culpability or responsibility. It allows them to get carried away by bullshit, you know, by the worst impulses at a very difficult age, without considering anything resembling consequences or moral sanction or any of that stuff. It's just a very different world. And I have a 13-year-old. I can't even pretend to understand it, but I can be scared absent anything like we're talking about the Steubenville incident. I can still be scared by kind of the boundarylessness and the absolute universality of it and my lack of control over it as a parent.
Yeah, man, it's so hard because that's part of it too. I think that was my other parallel with the school shootings is I think when people look at the school shootings, they don't think that they have to own it. They don't have to put the mirror up to themselves because most of us never really imagine ourselves rampaging through a public building shooting people. But I mean, sex is a part of normal human life, you know, unlike murder and killing necessarily. And I know you said there's something tribal, probably something tribal with killing too, that we've, you know, pushed out of our minds over time. But
but there's also in the case of the, you know, the most recent, you know, what we're talking about, the Aurora, you know, slaughter or you know, Sandy Hook. There, we're also talking about diagnosable mental illness to a pretty severe degree.
Right.
But that, which also leads us into other questions about, especially in the Sandy Hook Newtown massacre. You know, here's a mother who, putting the guns that she owned aside, who really didn't know what to do with a son who was mentally ill, who didn't want him stigmatized necessarily by entering what pretends to be a mental health care system for people who haven't been convicted of a crime or exonerated on the basis of insanity. And, you know, it's really a separate issue that people conflate along with the gun control and everything else.
Well, and that's a good point. And that even further kind of makes Steubenville different. You know, this kind of puts the mirror up to all of us. And that's part of what bugged me so much with the reaction to the sentencing yesterday was that even though I didn't do anything specifically, you know, I'm an adult male with kids who goes to, I watched four or five high school football games in person last year. You know, I'm online, and on all forms of social media all the time. I live a great portion of my life on social media. I feel like this is putting a lot of a mirror up to myself. I feel there's some self-reflection, if not guilt, that on me, just with all this, the culture that I've helped create. And I think as Americans, that's what bugs me. You know, you can't just look at this and say, all right, done deal. We found the criminals. It's all over.
I agree. And I, you know, whatever that personal responsibility with, you know, you're a father and that certainly is part of it. It's a part of it that I take seriously, you know, that it is not up to the schools or our spiritual leader or literature or our sports heroes to impart a strong sense of right and wrong, a strong sense of consequences, you know, that behavior has consequences. All that stuff is a matter of personal responsibility. And beyond that, you know, you want to be able to hold a school system accountable, you know, for what it does and doesn't do to perpetuate your own sense of value. Values and you know, right behavior. It's tough. I mean, we're talking about, you know, slow, incremental at best growth with any one human, and any one community. And so, yeah, I've always argued that the problem in this country is not too much guilt or shame. It's a lack of guilt and shame, a lack of a feeling like, you know what, this at some level is my responsibility too. But I didn't always feel that way. You know, it takes a long time to get there, and we are not encouraged in any way, shape, or form by by Twitter, by Facebook, by schools, by the media. We're very, very rarely forced to look at ourselves in the mirror and go, what role did I play in this in a community sense? And I'm guilty. You know, I'm guilty too. But what to do about it? I think one of the things, and one of the reasons I'm glad we're talking, is if you can't have some kind of dialogue about it, if you can't say things that are now, you know, considered really outside the bounds of polite discourse and you're pilloried for saying them, then there's no even possibility of growth.
Well, and this is one of the reasons that I pretty much banned myself from talking about this on social media over the last couple of days, because this conversation does not translate to that spitfire 140 character world. And man, I'm kind of, as somebody who loves social media, I love the immediacy of it. I'm starting to really hate its limitations and guide my life accordingly. Cause I know 2 years ago, I would have been having 10 conversations at once with people I disagreed with on the subtleties of this case. And they would have hated me and I would have been really pissed off at them. And instead I just held it back so that I could have a real longer conversation about it. But I still fear that, you know, we're still on that track of the short, curt messages that are taking the place of real conversation.
I think that's probably a good idea to stay off the subject in terms of Twitter, for sure. I mean, 140 characters, you know, just using the word subtle or nuance, you know, takes up a very high percentage of any one message. I think it would also be great, and this problem came up recently, in fact, now, in a different context, in the context of a Philadelphia magazine story called Being White in Philadelphia. There are parallels with the Steubenville case, but they have nothing to do with the specific crime in Steubenville or the issues raised by this cover story in Philadelphia magazine. What it's really about is how do you really get a dialogue going when everyone has positions are already hardened? And, you know, in one case, you've got, you know, white journalists, and that's a redundancy, really, in almost every place, every newsroom, every magazine, who are writing about issues that, you know, clearly would be better addressed much of the time by someone who wasn't just a middle-aged Caucasian male. And here we got you and me talking about the Steubenville case. It'd be great to have a conversation with, you know, a woman, you know, not necessarily a journalist, but someone, you know, who could really speak to some of these issues and the nuances and the feelings in a way that you and I may never be able to get to, and not because it's our fault. But
yeah, and I don't want to speak for you, but I don't think I know the situation of going into a party as a female who is, you know, pretty well instantly, you know, desired by a large percentage of the people at that, of the males at that party.
You know, this was another memory that is never far from me this triggered, this being the Steubenville case. I was an academic advisor in the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Iowa back in the late 80s. And so I was working with entering freshmen, sophomores who hadn't declared their major yet, some athletes, but you know, it wasn't a school that was particularly, I mean, it was a Big Ten school, still is, whatever they're calling that conference now. But I had a freshman woman, second semester, I believe, freshman year, distraught. She had gone to a party, the football player's dorm, passed out, vaguely remembered, you know, sex, and was presented with, and that football player was an upperclassman, went on to have a career in the pros, had let her know that he had had sex with her. He had taken photos, and if she didn't continue to put out for him and other teammates, he would send the photos to her parents. And she brought this to me as an academic advisor, and my advice was, I have no idea what to do, but you need to go to the administration.
That's some evil, evil shit.
No, but that's what I'm saying. I mean, this, again, we're dealing with, we're not talking about the, and I guess I'm harping on this because of the contrast between the coverage of Steubenville as a suburb that's down, really, we're reporting from a bar room in Steubenville. You know, that's been the tone of the coverage, is very class-driven, in much the same way that the coverage of the Glen Ridge rape case was class-driven.
Except there was no bar with a bunch of blue-collar guys getting shots at the end of the day.
Right, but this is just one of the things that the media does, is they rather than look at the similarities, the commonalities, the threads that really help to explain some of this, they're preoccupied with bullshit. And at the University of Iowa, she wound up going, and it wasn't handled to the extent that I was even aware of it. It wasn't handled at all. She went. It was the same kind of thing as apparently happened in Steubenville. People were aware of it. People in power were aware of it. They did nothing about it. The young woman eventually left the University of Iowa. Shame on me, because I certainly didn't think, I didn't dig into it. I can't tell you with any specificity what wound up happening. And so a lot of what we're talking about is this male-driven, sports-driven culture of, if you play ball, and in all three cases, by the way, Steubenville, University of Iowa, Glen Ridge, New Jersey, if you're a guy who plays ball, it doesn't matter if the team's a national championship team or not. It's that you're one of the tribe's great warriors. And if the football coach in the Steubenville case, the athletic director, or the people in the administration, University of Iowa, in that case, Glen Ridge, I'm not sure who knew what when among the school administration, but those boys were suspended. They were suspended from school for 10 days.
Yeah.
For basically raping a retarded girl. Oh, I used the wrong word, but that's what we're talking about. With a baseball bat and a broom handle. That was the school system's reaction. So, all this stuff is, again, it's horrific, but one of the really shocking things to me about it is how shocked everyone pretends to be. It happens all the time.
Well, and it's like being shocked absolves you from having to think about it, because
exactly.
It's an acceptable reaction.
Exactly. And I had no idea there was gambling in Casablanca. that's all it is. And without any of the knowing, self-aware comedy. And it justifies this parallel process of consigning these people to hell on a permanent, on a forever basis. I'm talking about the perpetrators in this case. They're the monsters. Putting them away as for as long as possible under the most brutal possible conditions, that's what we need in order to feel protected. From what? Until we address the larger issues in some way, how is it really going to do anything to move the culture forward?
All right, I've got a few more minutes, and I want to ask you one. I want to put you on the spot in an odd scenario that would never happen.
Okay.
So the Steubenville High School tracks you down and says, "Look, you're an experienced guy. You're well-read, you're worldly, Scott. We want you to come, and we want you to talk to our school before the school year starts in 2014. What in the world do you try and impart on those kids? I'm just trying to figure out, and I know that's an odd way of asking the question. You don't have to answer it like that. I'm just trying to figure out, what do you impart on as a starting point to this school?
The starting point really is, do you know the difference between right and wrong? And you would assume, I would assume that as a human being, endowed with a degree of consciousness and intelligence that falls into the normal category, you know exactly what the difference is. You know exactly what the difference is every day of your life you know you are not some monster or blank slate who really can't discern the difference between acting rightly or wrongly until you're charged with a crime, until someone finds out you cheated on the test, until your mother or father discovers that you took money out of his or her wallet. That has been true since you've been 5 or 6 years old, and it's just as true today. And whatever you do, you are the one responsible for it. Not your parents, not your teacher, not the priest, not the rabbi, not your lawyer, not the judge, not the coach. You are responsible for it, and you know you're responsible for it. And to hide behind any other, you know, idea of what reality is, and, oh, I was drunk, and, oh, I was this, and, oh, I was that, means you're not really a human being. You're just a little puppet who's being controlled by something else. If that's the way that you choose to live your life, you need to be aware that that's a decision that you're making. And that nothing excuses you from responsibility for your behavior. Nothing excuses that. And the idea of any religion really boils down to treating others as you would wish to be treated. That's the voice inside you that knows the difference between right and wrong. Not a fear of a spanking, not a fear of a jail sentence, but knowing in your heart whether you did right or wrong. You need to stay in touch with that. And any other way of living your life makes you less than a human being. And, you know, that, I mean, I don't know what more of a message you could deliver, especially in a situation where you are talking to people who are, you know, wounded freshly, you know, by, and I'm not just talking about the victim, I'm not just talking about the perpetrators, but an entire town that is now, Glen Ridge is going to be marked almost in perpetuity by this incident.
I think you're 100% right, and I think you probably hit on the core detail. What's surprising to me in the end is how often as humans we need to be reminded of that, though. I think you get a few reminders every year in the news or whatever else, but I think everybody can get their ego to the point where it gets in the way and they think they're above something. Certainly not necessarily to the level of these two criminals who are going to juvenile detention or whatever. But man, personal responsibility is a lesson that probably needs to be taught multiple times a year while all kids are growing up.
I think it's, you know, I always think about the Ten Commandments in this way. I mean, I'm not a huge organized religion guy, but you know, what's most interesting to me about the Ten Commandments is that they exist as they do. What I mean is this: if one tribe's version of a god needs to actually chisel "honor thy mother and thy father" into a stone tablet, or "thou shalt not kill," if that actually needs to, you know, if people need to be reminded of that to the extent that it needs to be one of the top 10 commandments, that tells you a lot about the human race. Not that I think God actually did that, but I'm saying if human nature, you know, which is driven, because we know we're mortal, which is so driven by fear and so driven by living only in this moment of primal desire or instinct, that Lord of the Flies type of environment, that we're all really kind of fighting to maintain some degree of moral rightness and of ongoing connection in the face of a scenario that is inevitably doomed. You know, we're all going to die. We know we're all going to, you know, you can't kind of overstate the fact. If we need to be told by a higher power not to kill each other, that says something fundamental about human nature. And I'm simply saying that, you know, no matter how many times we're reminded of this stuff, no matter how good our parents are, our teachers are, whatever, at reminding us of this, it's still going to be a challenge. It's always going to be a challenge, just on the basis of human nature. So when something like this happens, it means trying to adopt, you know, some attitude that mixes justice and mercy in the same kind of proportion reflected in figures like Jesus. It doesn't mean we're ever going to be, you know, like Jesus. It simply means that there, we can't simply retreat to another childish position where they're monsters or she's a whore or, you know, oh, well, they were drunk. Somehow we have to get bigger, larger, and more connected than that. And however much reminding it takes, I don't think any of these problems are ever going to go away. You just would like to think we can move towards something that connects us in more positive ways than screaming at each other.
Well, I knew if anybody was going to be able to help me tackle this this topic, it was going to be you. And I thank you for doing it with me. I know a lot of people would have avoided it, but you seem to want to jump right in.
You know, here's a funny thing, and whether you use this or not, I like this stuff, and I've been trying very hard, whether it's in my house or whether it's in a broader context, even in the LeBron book. You know, the horror of Akron, you know, trying to raise larger issues that are on the table for me all the time. And I love this stuff, and I'm grateful to be asked. But, you know, among the things that I'm doing more and more radio. And, you know, I do regular spots on a Philadelphia sports radio station, WIP. It's fantastic. And I do a Saturday morning spot on a Fox national radio show. And I did an overnight Sunday morning, 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. alone in Philly on WIP. One of the things that I always think about, because, you know, I'm a Cleveland guy. I mean, I haven't lived there for a long time, but you know how rooted I still am there. As many times as I've appeared on KNR and on 92.3 The Fan, I have let them know many times, hey, give me 5 minutes a week. I'm not asking for money, by the way, Craig. I can't get anyone in Cleveland radio interested in me.
Well, this is even better because I'm not only going to invite you, but I'm going to let you say fuck.
Well, as you can see, I know I have that freedom, and I haven't even thrown an F-bomb. But I've been doing radio for years without throwing F-bombs.
Yeah.
I just can't figure out why nobody in Cleveland sports radio has at least been interested. I mean, they are when something happens.
They probably think the price of free is too good to be true.
I don't get it. But believe me, it's frustrating because here we have, and it's not just sports, you know, here we have, you know, a place that, and look, you're one of them, is full of really bright, talented, creative, driven people who are looking at things, including the teams, in ways that, you know, really deserve to be broadcast. And if they can't provide an outlet for a homeboy with a national reputation, which, by the way, I actually have that reputation, if they can't find a way to use you, you know, to use Scott Sargent, to use a bunch of guys there, who can blame anyone for leaving? It's not like the LeBron scenario where you're getting offered a huge contract and the adoration of millions to stay home. In many cases, we're talking about guys who, as they come up through their 20s and 30s and have mouths to feed, have to leave Cleveland in order to ply their trade somewhere else. And I don't want to, I'm doing fine. It's not like I'm begging these people, hoping that I'll be able to buy groceries if they let me do radio. I'm just astounded by how moribund the media there actually are.
Yeah, well, I've been trying to crack that code. We've been trying to crack that code for over 5 years now. So if
Amazing.
We ever figure it out, we'll let you know.
Well, if I can ever be of any help, which obviously I cannot, but I'm offering anyway. It's sincere.
Thank you. I appreciate that very much.
You bet. You bet.
All right. And with that, this has been another WaitingForNextYear.com podcast.
Waiting for Next Year.